You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland. Thousands of students in Ireland will go on strike from school for one day today as they join millions of others all around the world as they protest against climate change. It's 1 year since Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg inspired a global movement of students to take to the streets to call on their governments to address arguably the biggest issue of this and future generations. We'll talk to two students here in just a moment. But first, here's Greta herself, who sailed to New York for next week's UN Climate Summit.
This is not a drill. My name is Greta Thunberg. We are living in the beginning of a mass extinction. Our climate is breaking down. Children like me are giving up their education to protest. But we can still fix this. You can still fix this.
That's Greta Thunberg there with her call to action. Well, all around the world, people are coming out in protest. Let's hear some of the sounds now from Kilimantang in Indonesia to the town of Geelong and Melbourne in Australia.
It is their duty to protect our planet, and so far they have failed. As we progress through this time of great luxury that comes at a cost that I think we don't truly understand, or perhaps more accurately appreciate, it is more vital than ever for positive change to come around. This is the damage we have inflicted on ourselves, and this is the damage we must fix. I am no idealist. It is no ideal of mine that this is a solution that can miraculously happen overnight. You know, it might take days, weeks, years even, but before resolution, there must be a drastic change.
Students from those parts of the world where the global action on climate change has already been taking place this morning. Well, joining us now in Morning Ireland are two students, 14-year-old Saoirse Exton, who's in our Limerick studio, and with us here in Dublin, 15-year-old Gráinne O'Sullivan from Bray in County Wicklow, and they both have a parent with them in this morning. Gráinne, first of all, Greta Thunberg there, we heard a clip of her calling on people to do what they can in relation to this issue. Did she inspire you?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I heard her first speak at a European event, and I just, because I have sustainability as a class in my school, we'd kind of heard her speeches in that class, and then to hear the words that she spoke and see her kind of tear up, and she kind of had a personal connection. I think to see that personal connection, I felt, oh, this is seriously a problem. Like, if one person feels so scared about such an issue, then maybe I should be too.
Saoirse, what about you? Did Greta inspire you, or what inspired you to do this today?
Yeah, Greta did inspire me. I have always been scared of climate change, but I've suppressed it a lot, you know, over the years. And then I saw Greta striking and I was like, whoa, she's doing something. So maybe I can do something too.
And Saoirse, where do you get your information from in relation to what's happening and the dangers that are facing our planet?
Well, I read lots of news articles in lots of different newspapers. And, you know, I keep up with things on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, social media is actually a huge help. It's been a huge help with actually finding out about things, you know, reading articles that people have tweeted about, reading articles that people have linked to. It's great, yeah.
Gráinne, what about you and your information?
Yeah, a lot of it does come through social media. And then I have sustainability as a class in my school. So it's great because you hear these things on social media, but in other schools there's no space for you to talk about it, so you're getting worried about these issues, but then there's nowhere to discuss it. And I think it's really great, like in my school and in Cork Educate Together, there's space for that to talk about, so you can kind of get which is the facts and which isn't. And
yeah,
it's great.
You're all future voters, of course, and that, I suppose, is the language that politicians understand ultimately. Gráinne, what are you saying to them this morning?
I think that we're demanding action. So they have an action plan. There is no action on it. And that's what we are demanding. We don't want just talk. We want the action that follows.
Specifically what?
Mostly kind of that the government ensures like all fossil fuels are left in the ground and no new fossil fuels infrastructures are built, 100% renewable energy, and that the government actually communicates the severity of this crisis to the general public, because there are people that still aren't aware how serious this issue is.
Saoirse, what are your demands specifically? Because obviously this is a global issue, it's a national issue, and they're both feeding into each other. So for you, what should this government's priority be?
Well, I definitely agree with Grace there, and about education. For instance, in my school, we don't have anything like sustainability classes. We're not taught about that. We're not taught about the severity of it, and we're not taught about how to look after ourselves. I've been telling people about it, and I'm not a climate scientist, so I don't know all the points, and I don't know everything about it. I just tell them as much as I know, and they get scared and they say, how are we supposed to survive this? And I'm like, I don't know, you know. So I think education is very important. And then the other thing would definitely be looking after the biodiversity in Ireland. Our biodiversity is incredibly unique, and Ireland used to be almost an entirely forested nation, and now it has barely any forests left, and people have begun to forget what those forests look like. And then looking at the Climate Action Plan, they suggest using Sitka spruce trees for the reforestation of Ireland. And Sitka spruce trees actually destroy the biodiversity, and they're not using native trees. So that's a big, big demand for me, yeah.
Okay, and Gráinne, in relation to the fossil fuels, I mean, have you read the Climate Action Plan? Or
yeah, I have. Yeah. And when I'm looking at it, sometimes I think that sometimes there's no dates for these actions.
Yeah. But there's a lot of dates, is there not? I mean, yeah, it all centres around 2030.
Yeah, 2030. But by that stage, we want it before then. We have 11 years to kind of act on this, and after that this is irreversible, so really it needs to be done before that 11 years happens. We don't want everything to happen in 2030 and then not everything be done, because this is our future that needs to be respected, and the government are currently not respecting our future.
But they say they want 70% of our electricity from renewables by 2030. They want all fossil fueled cars essentially done away with by the end of 2045, heating systems ended by 2035. It's not going to happen overnight. I mean, you accept that, presumably. It's a very slow process.
Yeah, it does. It takes a while, and that's why we need it to be happening as soon as it's possible. It can't just be years down the line that they decide, oh, maybe we should start doing about something this. Currently, they're just talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk. This needs to happen. They need to act on it. We need, we don't need 70%. We need 100%.
Saoirse, what have you changed, I suppose, in your own life to demonstrate your commitment to climate action?
Well, we have an electric car at home, and we also have we have loads of trees in our garden that have been growing for several years. A lot of them, I think most of them are native trees. We grow some of our own food. Not a lot of it, but we do grow as much as we can. You know, we have like carrots and radishes and loads of apples and courgettes as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Gráinne, I suppose over the last week in particular, we've heard quite a bit about the unsustainability of the fashion industry, the fast fashion, how cheaply it's made because it's wearable only on a couple of occasions and then it's thrown away. I mean, do you think ethically about your clothes and where you buy them and how you buy them?
Yeah, definitely. Like when I try to make as many responsible decisions I can towards actions like that. So when I try to buy vintage clothes, and that's something anyone can do at home. You go to a charity shop or a vintage shop. There's like hundreds around the country, and not buy new clothes. Like there's hundreds of clothes in the world that there's thousands and billions of pieces of clothing that can last us for years. Mm-hmm. And yet they're still making more clothes in fast fashion industries.
So Saoirse, just finally today, what are you expecting there in Limerick?
I'm expecting a big crowd. I'm expecting people will be angry, especially over the recent, how EPA recently allowed the Irish cement to begin incinerating waste in the plant.
We were talking about that earlier on the program.
I heard that.
Yeah.
um, yeah, I'll be expecting lots of angry people, I think. In a good way, though. You know, positively angry.
Okay. And Grania, what are you looking forward to today?
Yeah, well, I think it's great. It's very exciting because in Dublin we've been planning for weeks, and then for it to kind of finally come to this day, it's very exciting, and we're hoping for really big numbers as the adults are joining us this time. And there's thousands of students that have signed up on the action maps around the country. So it's really exciting. Okay. Hopefully big numbers.
Well, good luck to you both. And thank you for taking part in our discussion on this issue this morning. 15-year-old Grania O'Sullivan from Bray, 14-year-old Saoirse Exton joining us from our Limerick studio this morning.
Who makes decisions for you when you can't make them for yourself? Decisions about where you live, what medical treatment you'll have, your family, your friends, or you through a solicitor. Safeguarding Ireland is calling for help, financial help, to ensure more people can afford legal backup under Enduring Power of Attorney. They're an umbrella group who work together to protect vulnerable adults, and their chairperson, Patricia Rickard-Clark, is here. Patricia, thank you very much for coming into us this morning.
Morning, Gavin.
Can you explain to us what Enduring Power of Attorney is?
An enduring power of attorney is you make it when you have capacity to provide for a situation, to appoint somebody, an attorney, can be a family member, a friend or whatever, to make your financial and legal decisions when you no longer have that capacity. And in relation then to care, treatment decisions and place of care decisions, you can make an advanced healthcare directive.
Can you give me an example of how this arises?
Well, it arises, say, if you have an accident or serious illness, or now with our demographics, many older people have dementia and there's a state where a person is not in a position to make their own decisions. So if you're going to hospital, the healthcare professional does need your consent for treatment. So your treatment decision, you're making it in advance to articulate your wishes. Recent survey done by Safeguarding Ireland has indicated only 6% of people have done an enduring power of attorney. This gives rise to huge difficulties in terms of finances, where people know there is no particular person appointed to make those decisions. It leads to abuse of people and financial abuse. 10% is estimated do not work honestly with vulnerable person's finances. So it's really important to prevent abuse, and also in terms of your treatment wishes, that you're not, for example, also put into a nursing home against your wishes, that people know what your wishes are. So all of those very important points.
Do those decisions not fall to next of kin?
No.
Anyway?
No. And that is, I suppose, an idea that people have. Sage Advocacy did a survey last year on next of kin's view or opinion on this. Most people think next of kin have the authority.
Yeah, your partner or your children.
They do not unless they are legally appointed by you.
Oh.
That is why it's so, so important. And that is why, for example, there are sometimes the repercussions of not having an advanced treatment plan or a place of care decision is there are delayed discharges in hospital. This is not highlighted. So people are left in acute hospitals. What happens as a result of that? There's a huge cost to the state in that, in terms of that delayed discharge, but also it may be necessary then to have a person taken into wardship, a court application. Court application should be a last resort, but at the moment, in many cases, it's the only resort to actually then have somebody appointed to make decisions on your behalf.
So if I can't make the decision and my wife or my children are not allowed to make the decision and I haven't appointed somebody to do it, who makes the decision for me?
Well, in terms of your financial decisions, that is the problem. There is nobody entitled, and that gives rise to huge, as you can imagine, resource costs of trying to work around that, and that is where the abuse arises, because people then try and informally make arrangements, which doesn't always work out well for the individual.
Okay.
Person.
So how do I appoint somebody and how much does it cost me to do that?
So you need a solicitor to make an enduring power of attorney. You do not need a solicitor, but you should consult a GP or a doctor in relation to your healthcare decision or preferences. So that is why Safeguarding Ireland are calling for now that the state promote a scheme which would allow community organisations, solicitors and GPs to engage with people. So representative organisations, community organisations could actually put supports in place.
Does it cost money to do this?
It does cost money to make an EPA because you do need the services of a solicitor. It varies depending on your situation, and but I the quotes that I've heard recently are something between 600 to 1,000 euro. So it is an expensive, so that's why Safeguarding Ireland feel that there should be, because there's the cost to the state as well. So if the cost, if the state encouraged people to make these, it would save a lot of later costs. So really important that people do plan ahead in advance and prevent abuse.
Patricia Rickard-Clark, who is chairperson of Safeguarding Ireland, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning.
Are we witnessing the beginning of the end of the beef protests? Well, protesters outside the ABP meat processing factory at Ferrybank in County Waterford ended their blockade last night. Earlier in the evening, protesters outside Dawn Meats in Slane in County Meath also stood down. They've been protesting for several weeks now over the price they're getting for their cattle. Our Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent Fran McNulty joins us now this morning from the National Ploughing Championships in County Carlow. Fran, first of all, the protesters in Waterford and Slane, why did they decide to stand down?
Many of them are now saying that in Slane they actually issued a statement, Audrey, to say they're doing it because they believe dialogue is the way forward and staying on the picket lines any longer just isn't the way to do it. They talk about division and aggression not being constructive at this point in time. It has to be said, this morning news is coming through that in Ferrybank, where that vote was taken last night, I understand by it was carried, nine people, the vote was carried... I'm sorry, I'm a little confused here, Audrey. The vote was carried. A majority of nine people decided this was the way to go in terms of the overall vote. And at that point, there was a lot of tension and confusion. People interjected, said, we don't accept this vote. We don't accept it's carried, even though the majority of people have voted for it, and we are going to continue protesting. And similar situations have happened around the country. So officially, the majority of people have voted to stand down in Ferrybank. That has happened in Slane too. In Kerr last night, it was a different situation. Even before a vote could happen, a decision was made not to take the vote because a small number of people there said, no matter what happens here tonight, no matter what is voted, we are continuing the blockade. And in Kerr, the majority of people walked away. Many of them I spoke to last night said the moderates walked away and decided that there was nothing to be gained from continuing these blockades on the plants. So it's a really confused situation. You've blockades been stood down, you've people insisting they want to hold out, you've splits within representative groups, splits within splits of representative groups. It's a messy picture, Audrey, but it does appear that there is an appetite to move away from the gates.
Yeah, and the IFA issuing a statement this morning, Joe Healy, urging the factories to reopen and come forward with a strong base price for cattle, but also saying that the IFA will support any farmer who wants to sell their animals.
And I think that line in Joe Healy's statement really says it all. Many people who tried to sell cattle when these pickets would have started, Audrey, would be aware that there was quite a lot of hostility on the gates. There was some severe abuse of people who tried to sell cattle into plants. And really what Joe Healy is saying there is that the time is now, if people want to sell cattle, and people are under immense pressure to sell cattle. Particularly in the west of Ireland, there was a wet period over recent weeks. A lot of cattle are taken off grass, they're housed. Now that's costing money to keep them there. The longer they're there, the lower the price goes, because many of them will go over 30 months in terms of the grading system. The issues will arise in terms of their value when they're eventually sold into the factory. So that kind of pressure is building. Another society yesterday, the Angus Beef Ireland, saying they've 7,000 members and many of them need to sell cattle, need to sell them urgently. They have bills, and they are saying as well, look, enough is enough. We have something. It's not perfect. We can talk about the agreement. We can make progress. But really, the meat industry needs to get moving again. And you see that headline in the Farmers Journal this morning, 120 million worth of cattle backed up in the system. That's going to take time to clear. And then when there's an oversupply, that's going to affect the price people get too.
Yeah, I mean, money's at the base of this dispute. It will be resolved one way or another. But after that, Fran, I mean, there are so many massive issues facing the beef industry, not least the Mercosur trade deal with South America and, of course, Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big issue, okay? The reality here is the price farmers are being paid for their cattle is not sustainable. It is simply not viable. They need around 4.17 a kilo to break even. They're getting around 3.50. The Meat Industry Ireland say that's in line with European average. There's a depressed market out there. Many of the farmers say we don't supply an average product. We supply an above average product and we should be getting an above average price for it. But all of these problems around that will pale into insignificance. For example, if you had a no-deal Brexit, the tariffs that will be imposed on beef will just wipe the industry out. We export 90% of our product. Over 50% of beef from this country is exported into the UK market. Many of the UK supermarket chains and restaurants supply Irish beef. So if you had a no-deal Brexit, it would be catastrophic for the industry. And there is a lot of commentary here at the Ploughing this week, Audrey, that whilst all, and this is from people within the beef sector, all of this focus on what's going on the factory gates, all of this focus on this, and all the while the issues around Brexit are being pushed down the agenda. And people are saying we really now need to start focusing on Brexit and those bigger issues, you know, the trade deal. And, you know, people are kind of at this point saying, a lot of them, privately, enough is enough.
All right, Fran, for now, thank you very much, our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty.
A committal hearing takes place in court in Derry today in the case of Soldier F, the former British paratrooper charged with two murders and four counts of attempted murder on Bloody Sunday in Derry in 1972. Soldier F, who's not been named, is not required to appear in court for today's hearing. Our Northern correspondent, Vincent Kearney, can tell us more. Vincent, the Soldier F case in court for the first time today, what's expected to happen?
That's right, Brian. Well, Soldier F is to be charged formally with two counts of murder on Bloody Sunday in Derry in January 1972, the killings of James Ray and William McKinney. Also to be charged with four counts of attempted murder. Now, it's the first listening of the case being heard at Bishop Street Courthouse in Derry at 10 o'clock this morning. The decision to prosecute the former member of the Parachute Regiment was announced back in March. Since then, the Public Prosecution Service in Northern Ireland has been preparing committal papers, including witness statements and other evidence that supports a prosecution case. Now, this is expected, Brian, to be a contested committal. That means Soldier F, his defence team, is expected to contest elements of the prosecution case. So the hearing will be a timetabling exercise. That means it'll be quite technical. It's likely to be short, with very little, if indeed any, details of the nature of the evidence likely to be revealed today. Now, this will happen at a committal hearing. Those details of evidence will happen at a committal hearing at a future date when a magistrate will rule whether there's sufficient evidence for the case to proceed. And it could be several months for the case to proceed to that point.
Right. Now, Soldier F himself won't actually be there. He won't be in court. Why is that? And how are the families of those killed on Bloody Sunday reacting to that?
Well, that's right, Brian. Put simply, there is no legal requirement for Soldier F to attend today because this is a committal hearing and it's understood he has no intention of doing so. But his legal team will be there, of course. He will deny the charges against him. They will deny them on his behalf and, as I say, are likely to contest some elements of the prosecution case against him. Now, some family members are quite angry about this. They've said that they want justice to be seen to be done as well as being done. They're keen to see Soldier F in court in person. They will hold a press conference, Brian, I understand, this morning outside court just before the hearing. And they're likely to welcome the fact that finally this case is getting to court. And I understand they will also make clear that they want to see Soldier F in the dock in person at some point if this progresses to Crown Court for trial. But even if that does happen, Brian, the question then will be which court? Some legal sources say they expect Soldier F's legal team to apply to have any future trial moved out of Derry on security grounds. They may argue that he could be in danger. There's the added element, of course, of his supporters. Many military veterans and supporters have taken part in rallies supporting him right across the United Kingdom and including in Belfast. They're demanding an end to prosecutions of former soldiers during the Troubles. So it's highly likely that if Soldier F was to appear in court in person at any future date, those groups would turn up to demonstrate their support whilst families of the victims of Bloody Sunday and their supporters would also be outside the court. Now, that could be quite a volatile mix. And the legal team for Soldier F, of course, Brian could also point to the fact that back in January this year, the new IRA detonated a van bomb outside this very courthouse in Derry.
Just finally, Vincent, what about the timescale for all this? If the case moves to trial, when is that likely to take place?
This will be a long process. As I say, it could be months before we even move to the stage where a magistrate rules formally on whether or not there's sufficient evidence for this case to go to trial in the Crown Court. Legal sources say it could be potentially be a number of years before the trial actually takes place. This is Soldier F. We understand why he's not being named, as the man is late 60s, so at that point he'll be in his early 70s. I told that at the earliest stage, that certainly in terms of the legal teams, they say we're looking at 2, 3, possibly even up to 4 years, some of them think, before this could go to trial.
Vincent Kearney in Derry, thank you very much indeed for that.
We reported some weeks ago about a big increase in the number of Leaving Certificate exam results that were appealed this year, almost double last year. You might remember the case of one student last year, Rebecca Carter, who went to the High Court to successfully get a place in university after an appeal of her exam results saw her get higher grades. Well, not only was there a big increase in the number of appeals this year, there was also a big increase in results upgrades as well. Our education correspondent is Emma O'Kelly.
Yes, Gavin, last year and the year before, for the past number of years, around 9,000 individual grades achieved in the Leaving Certificate have been appealed every year. And again, for last year and the year before, we had around 1,400 upgrades being granted to students. Now, this year, we had that huge, almost doubling in the number of individual grades appealed, jumping from 9,000 to around 17,000 appeals. But surprisingly, this year, we've had a matching increase in the number of successful appeals. The number of upgrades being granted also has actually more than doubled this year. This is surprising because one would imagine the overall proportion of grades upgraded each year should be more or less constant. It shouldn't be the case that simply because many more students are appealing the results that many more students get upgrades.
What question marks does this raise about the marking of results?
Well, if I could explain this in an extreme way, we had 16% of papers appealed last year upgraded. We had 17%, almost the same number of papers appealed this year upgraded. And the extreme example I'm going to give you is if everybody appealed every paper that they sat in the Leaving Certificate results, would that proportion remain the same? Would 17% of all papers sat in the Leaving Cert be successful on appeal? And if you look into individual subjects, Gavin, there's an overall 17% success rate, but it's much higher in some subjects. For example, students who appealed higher level maths, 23 of those appeals resulted in upgrades. That's almost a quarter. In Spanish, a subject that not many students take, but 24% of people who appealed at the result that they received in August received an upgrade as a result. In a subject like Japanese, a very small number of students sitting that exam, out of 13 appeals, 5 were successful. That's an amazing success rate of 38%. So this does seem to reveal some kind of a flaw either in the original marking of papers or else in the marking of appeals.
Some students got upgrades even though they didn't ask for an appeal. Why?
Yes, now Gavin, this is something that is not unusual. We had a situation in maths and a few other subjects where an anomaly or an issue that was discovered in the paper due to an appeal that a student would have made. Now, when they discover an issue like this, and this is part of the normal quality assurance process, examiners then will go on and look and see, well, perhaps another student was caught out by the same error on our part. And for example, in maths, it related to higher level paper one. It was a tiny mark, it was one mark, the equivalent of one mark on that paper, is related to question 3B, and examiners decided the result of an issue that arose, as I say, during the appeals process, to go back and look at 30 papers, and these were papers where there was one mark between one grade and another grade that the student could have achieved. In 26 of these cases, examiners decided to award that one extra mark to a student, and this brought those students up. And there were 19 other cases in other subjects where a similar process happened. judgment.
And in just two cases, the appeals saw a downgrade in results. Can these students, Emma, now go to their preferred course with their higher points, or is it too late?
No, it shouldn't be too late. This will affect just a small proportion of the students who received upgrades, but there will be students today who may have paid deposits on accommodation, may have moved to a city, and then discover, because of the upgrading process, that they actually have a place that they wanted more, but that might be in another city, for example. So they will have difficult choices to make. Do they stay where they are, or do they up sticks and move again? One other point that's important, Gavin, it costs money to appeal, and given the strong success rate and the jump in the success rate based on the number of appeals, that's an important factor. It costs €40 per paper to appeal. Now, you get your money back if your appeal is successful, but that cost is prohibitive for many. However, it seems that if you can afford the €40 to appeal a paper or several papers, that it seems that it may very well be money very well spent.
That's our education correspondent, Emma O'Kelly, speaking to us earlier.
Taoiseach Leo Varadkar met the DUP leader Arlene Foster for a private one-to-one meeting in Dublin last night. Earlier in the evening, Mrs. Foster gave a speech to the Dublin Chamber of Commerce, at which she repeated that Northern Ireland must leave the EU customs union and single market. She also said that her party was prepared to be flexible and look at Northern Ireland's specific solutions if they have cross-community support. Speaking to journalists before her speech, Mrs. Foster said she believed a deal was possible.
My party has never been a no-deal party. We recognise that no deal had to be kept on the table so that we could get a good deal. But we want to get a good deal, and we're working hard to try and make sure that that happens for ourselves in Northern Ireland, for the whole of the UK, and indeed for our neighbours here in the Republic of Ireland as well. So what we want to see is a deal that works, to recognise the constitutional position of Northern Ireland, but also recognises that we're on an island and we have to recognise that as well. And we want to be able to do that and to work forward to get a deal that works in those circumstances.
That was Arlene Foster speaking to our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman, who was in Dublin last night, and Tommy joins us now. Tommy, the meeting with Leo Varadkar, will you tell us what you believe the significance of that has been?
Well, it wasn't planned long in advance. There was a possibility it might happen yesterday, and I think it was only firmed up as the day developed. And I think the Taoiseach's advisor on Northern Ireland, a man called Jim Darcy, who's a former Fine Gael senator, who has been doing an awful lot of the tic-tacking between Dublin and the DUP. Jim Darcy was instrumental in setting up that meeting. He was actually at the chamber event in the Intercontinental Hotel. But it was very, very interesting when Arlene Foster went to government buildings at around 9:30 last night, she met the Taoiseach alone, just the two of them in a room, no advisers, no officials. So I think the significance of what's going on is that we heard Leo Varadkar say when Boris Johnson came over, and he was quite welcoming to him. There was no, I suppose, public around the place when that meeting was taking place on the steps of government buildings, unlike what happened in Luxembourg. Everything was very, very calm. Everything was very, very mannerly. Protocol was done properly. But the Taoiseach said on that occasion that a promise doesn't amount to a legal guarantee. I think what we had last night, Audrey, was goodwill on top of a number of promises, but we still don't have the legal guarantees. But certainly, like, I was with Arlene Foster early in the afternoon yesterday. She was in the Murrayan Hotel before she went out to the Intercontinental Hotel. And you could see she was very, very conscious that she was trying to do something. She had crossed the border. She can be quite, I suppose, alert, even tense on those occasions. And you could see she recognised the significance of what was going on. She was crossing the border. She was going to this event where there was going to be a private question and answer session. And probably at the back of her mind, she knew that not firmly nailed down was the possibility of a meeting with the Taoiseach as well. Mm. So there's something going on so many levels. But is it there yet? Not at all.
Yeah. And was there any statement after the meeting? Because, I mean, relations haven't been good. I mean, it's just a few weeks ago that she was on this programme and other media on the same morning accusing Leo Varadkar of being belligerent, telling him to dial down the rhetoric, and her party, for a long while now has blamed him for the inability to agree a deal on Brexit.
Very, very brief statement issued that they had met, that they had discussed Brexit and storing their assembly at Stormont. And remember, the Secretary of State was down in Dublin in recent days. So that's going on as well. I think the wider significance of it is the speech itself that she gave to the chamber. We should put that up on the website in the course of the morning. That was very, very carefully crafted. In her interview, she did an interview with me. It's up on our website already. Before she travelled out to the Intercontinental, then she did a doorstep with journalists on her way in there as well. Nothing afterwards. But like, if you take the bigger picture, if you take, say, the mess that happened in Luxembourg, then if you look at the comments by the Finnish Prime Minister, they have the EU presidency, that Boris Johnson has until the 30th of September to come up with proposals. If you take the fact that the Conservative Party has its conference coming up, my understanding is Arlene Foster is going over to speak at a meeting on the margins of that. If you take the fact that Boris Johnson might meet a Taoiseach in New York on the margins of General Assembly of the United Nations next week, you have all this political activity going on. And in some respects, frustration in the EU. It's almost like trying to get somebody out of bed in the morning, the homework not done, last minute rush. And is it going to amount to a hill of beans? Still can't be sure. But I can gather this in my bones. I'm watching it in Northern Ireland. What's driving an awful lot of this is the recognition that if there's no deal, the chaos that will ensue. Like the story we've been covering for a number of days in recent times, the problem with farmers south of the border. Can you just imagine, Audrey, if there's a no deal Brexit and you have farmers in County Fermanagh not getting access to the CAP, their neighbours a few fields away, still supported by the European Union. And if that equation is repeated on time and time again in so many sectors, it's just going to be really, really challenging.
Did you see anything or hear anything, read anything in her speech, Tommy, though, that gave any indication that there was movement? Because she's still very much opposed to the backstop in any form, Northern Ireland only, UK-wide. And she's very clear Northern Ireland must leave the customs union and the single market with the rest of the UK.
I saw lots of evidence of movement. Look, for the DUP, Geoffrey Donaldson doing it on a number of our programmes, Arlene Foster at it again last night, stating the obvious, that when she and Martin McGuinness were in government together, they worked at producing a paper that recognised the special position of Northern Ireland that was extremely nuanced, that took a week to negotiate, a page and a half. And when she's harping back to that, before the balance in the DUP changed, when there was power sharing, that's important. And if you hear her talking about Northern Ireland specific measures, recognising the unique situation of the island of Ireland, that's all a change. But what's not changed is there is nowhere like the kind of detail that the European Union wants to see how its single market is going to be protected, because that detail isn't there. Yeah. And I think that recognises the comments we were getting from the Finnish Prime Minister yesterday, that you have until the 30th of September to come up with the concrete measures.
OK, Tommy, for now, thank you, our Northern Editor.
My body cost the same amount as the rent. Comments from a tenant known as Laura, who decided to go public with her story. She shared text messages between her and her landlord in which he asked for sex instead of rent. The issue of sex for rent was raised in the Dáil yesterday by Solidarity TD Ruth Coppinger. And following that, Laura shared her story with our reporter Alva Keneally.
I was living with my flatmate, then I had to leave the apartment because she was living in the country. So then I talked to him saying, like, could I stay here in the apartment for, like, less price? And then he said to me, like, I am so sorry, but I can't, you know, I need the money. So then, like, 4 days before I was leaving the house, he sent me a message, like, well, asking me if I wanted to live with him. And then I thought he was kind of joking. So then is when I asked him, is it for free? And then he said, no, it's not for free. I mean, it's for free, but maybe something else. So then I asked him if he was being serious. And then when he said, yes, I am, you know, I think you are beautiful and all these kind of things,
Were you shocked?
Yeah, I was shocked, of course I was, because I wasn't expecting, you know, like this relationship of landlord-tenant to have, you know, like, because when I asked him for the price, if I could stay for less, it's because I want to pay, you know, like I'm working and I really want to pay for my rent as another person. So I was like very in shock when he asked me this, because I felt like a sexual object, you know, at the end, like my body costs the same amount as the rent, you know.
In terms of these texts, were these the first kinds of texts that you got?
Like, he was having kind of comments sometimes, you know, like my friend, well, my bedmate, actually, she went on holiday, so he was telling me, like, you know, I might pop in to see how it goes in here. And I got scared because he has the keys of the apartment. So I was locking the door. Maybe he wasn't going to do anything, but you never knew if he would come or he wouldn't. So I was kind of afraid as well because of that.
Now, that was the tenant known as Laura, speaking to our reporter Alva Keneally yesterday. Joining us now in studio is Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Awful to hear the situation that Laura was put in. This sort of behaviour isn't new, though. You have come across this before.
Yeah, so particularly what Laura was talking about there at the end, we run the national 24-hour helpline from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and we would have occasions where people would be complaining about inappropriate behaviour by landlords, feeling unsafe, feeling uneasy. So this has come up. Occasionally, we have come across the situation as well of people saying they have been propositioned by landlords, effectively propositioned for sex in repayment for free or reduced price accommodation. So we have come across it, maybe not as much as is out there, because it's not necessarily the kind of thing that people know that they can get support from, and often they don't even realise quite how wrong it is. But to be totally clear, it is entirely unacceptable to have a situation where somebody would proposition a vulnerable person, a person who's vulnerable because they don't have enough money or because they haven't accommodation and might be homeless, to proposition them for sexual activity is entirely wrong and unacceptable and may even be a criminal offence. To be clear.
The may even be a criminal offence. Where do we stand on the law in regard to this?
All right. So the law says that somebody who propositions a prostitute for sexual activity, for money or other consideration, is committing an offence. Now, prostitution itself is not an offence in Ireland anymore, but the person who makes the proposition is committing an offence if they do it. Well, the thing is that a person who will have to consider themselves as in prostitution in order to come within that category. So there is law there. It's not a law that has been advanced very far. I don't know of any prosecutions that have taken place, but it may very well be. And the propositioning also amounts to sexual harassment and a breach of tenancy agreements very often as well.
In the Dáil yesterday, the Minister for Housing said he would speak to the Minister for Justice about collating the sort of data that is required here. Yeah. And that's something that you would support.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The real problem for us is we don't have data on this. In fact, we don't have data about the prevalence of various trends in sexual violence at all. But we do know that people who are vulnerable for any reason are more likely to be taken advantage of, are likely to be exploited, and therefore to be assaulted and even raped. So from that point of view, it is not a surprise, but it would be great to have data. There isn't enough data in general, and there certainly isn't enough data about this. They started collecting it in the UK, and they found that over a period of 2 years, 140,000 people reported having been at least propositioned for accommodation, for sex in exchange for accommodation.
Finally, and very briefly, Nolene, unfortunately, we spoke earlier about the campaign to get more girls on their bikes, and we heard from some schoolgirls who said that being verbally harassed while they were on the bikes was putting them off cycling.
All right.
And women have to change their behaviour then if they want to do something. That's the message that we're hearing this morning.
Right. So in a sense, this is a really important point as well, and there's an organisation, Women on Wheels, which has done a survey to show that actually the experience of women cyclists is different to men cyclists. cyclists, but that very often people are only looking at cycle lanes and hard things instead of the experience of women on the streets. So we need to adjust the way that we deal with our public spaces, because people should be able to wear what they want, walk where they want, without assault of any kind, physical, sexual or otherwise.
Nolan, thank you so much. Nolan Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre.
Thousands of people are expected to gather in Eyre Square in Galway this evening for the official release of the Galway 2020 programme, the events marking Galway's year as European City of Culture. After a series of controversies, resignations and financial difficulties, Galway 2020 is hoping to put past difficulties behind it as the city looks forward to the coming 12 months of arts and cultural activities. Arthur Lappin is chairman of Galway 2020 and he joins us now. Very good morning to you, Arthur Lappin, and thanks for taking our call this morning.
Good morning, Brian.
So what can people expect when you unveil the programme this evening?
Well, I think they can certainly be absolutely sure that all of the things that you talked about from the past are very firmly in the past. This is an absolutely joyful day for Galway 2020. Really, we are releasing our programme, which contains 154 projects over almost 2,000 events throughout next year. Very happy to say that 116 of those 154 will be free events to the public, because we're anxious that this is accessible to as many people as possible. Tonight in Eyre Square, we have a sort of a spectacular rig. People in Galway will already be aware that the rig is in place, mm-hmm. and it'll give us a little taste of the spectacular nature of what's to come next year. So we're absolutely thrilled. We're on target in every aspect of what we're doing, and we're looking forward to an absolutely fantastic year.
And
through 2020.
What kind of events and activities can people look forward to?
I think there will be huge sort of spectacular public events, like the opening ceremony, which is being put together with Wonderworks, the organisation that have managed the opening of, I think, the last five or six Olympic Games worldwide. But there are also many intimate, smaller scale events. There's one that we particularly love called See Tamagotchi, which involves the artist Mancon McGann going around the coast of Ireland and gathering words associated with the coastal regions which are no longer being used in Irish, and he is actually then going to present these words individually to people around the country, and their job, like Tamagotchis of old, is to try and keep that word alive into the future. So there are small intimate events, but there are also enormous spectacles, and there are a huge number of community events that have already started through our Small Towns Big Ideas program.
There really is
something for everybody in the programme. I don't believe there'll be a single person in Galway, or indeed in the region, that won't be impacted in some way by Galway 2020.
A lot of the difficulties which we were reporting on, and people were well aware of certainly throughout last year, centred on finance and the budget provision for what you're describing, obviously, as a very busy and, you know, quite a costly programme to mount. Are the finances in place? Is the money there now?
Absolutely. We have a value proposition at the moment of just under 40 million euro. We are obviously a project of this scale and this duration. We have by no means given up on funding or fundraising. We continue to do that every day. We're particularly in the private sector. There are new private sector sponsors coming on board every single day. And we have programme lined up to that if and when we raise additional finance, the 154 projects that I mentioned earlier will grow in number as we succeed in attracting more and more funding. But the funding that we need to provide the programme that we're publishing today is together, and people should have no concerns on that.
And a final question, and it's something you emphasised when you were appointed chair earlier this year, the legacy, a lasting legacy beyond next year. What would you hope might be that legacy?
my goodness, it's a legacy is such a huge part of what we're trying to achieve. Like, the year itself will be extraordinary, but I think European capitals of the country in the past have found that for at least a decade following the hosting of the year, that the positive impacts on communities and on in terms of capacity building, physical infrastructure, strengthening of community networks, and particularly from our point of view, an opportunity for new generation of artists in Galway to practice in Galway over the years ahead. I think that all of those things, it's an enlargement and a deepening, I suppose, of the cultural relationship of the community and the cultural sector.
Okay.
And I think it will be very profound. It's very hard to measure, and we will be measuring that in collaboration with NUIG. There's a very substantial monitoring and evaluation program that will, over a period of years, both during and after Galway 2020, to measure the impact.
We leave it there. I hope you have a terrific night tonight, and I'm sure you'll encourage anyone who can to get into Ayr Square.
It's going to be fantastic. The weather is great in Galway.
Great, yeah, you've been blessed.
Great.
Take care. Thank you very much for talking to us.
There's just 5 days to go to the start of the Rugby World Cup in Japan. It begins on Friday with a clash between the host nation and Russia in Tokyo. Ireland launched their campaign, as Darren said, against Scotland on Sunday. It's the first time the tournament has been held in Asia and outside one of the game's traditional powers, as World Rugby hopes to promote the game in a new frontier. Our reporter Paul O'Flynn is in Japan ahead of the big kickoff.
The morning rush in downtown Tokyo. Throngs of commuters swarm in an efficient silence, politely queuing for the next metro, shuttle or bullet train in Japan's bewildering transport system. The sights and smells of the streets are an assault on the senses, especially for those arriving from the west, like the thousands coming for the Rugby World Cup. But in a city of 38 million, it's fair to say tournament fever isn't exactly taking hold.
In Japan, rugby is not so big, so we don't know much about. But it's great to host a great event.
Hideki Mimura is chairman of the St. Patrick's Day Japan Committee.
There are not so many Irish people, but there are so many Japanese interested in Ireland. So in each city, we set up a group, volunteer group, especially for the Rugby World Cup, and we are trying to expand this celebration and promotion of Ireland all over Japan.
That'll be taken to a new level over the next few weeks. Ireland's ambassador to Japan, Paul Kavanagh, says Ireland is in the spotlight like never before as the number one ranked team and, of course, playing the host nation in their second game.
We're capitalising on that by organising a major promotional exercise. There's a number of ministers and high-level officials coming over, agencies. Minister Humphreys is going to lead a week-long trade mission. And altogether, Ireland is going to be promoted like it never has been to exploit the opportunity of the World Cup.
Well, it's all about presentation and gifts here in Japan.
So businesses, too, are hoping to cash in.
Something nice and has really been made for the Japanese palate.
Fiacra Martin has started his own Irish whiskey brand, tailored for the Japanese market.
About 120 years now they're making whiskey, and it's all about scotch for them, though. So they're very focused on peated whiskies and smoked whiskies, and we're all trying to kind of raise the category over here and try and, you've seen how many distilleries are opening back home, try and open up this big market to Ireland.
Rob Hennessy from Clontarf in Dublin has been living here for 9 years. He's going to all four group games with his wife Yumi and their baby son.
Here in Yokohama, which is the host city, the people are very aware of it. But I live on the other side in the relatively rural spot. So out there they wouldn't be that aware of it. But maybe once the games start, I'd say they'll all jump on board and get excited about it.
And for your little son here, Desmond, who's 7 months old, will he be wearing an Irish jersey or a Japanese jersey?
Ireland jersey. Yes, of course.
And for those travelling over,
I know that Irish supporters are always very friendly, and they make good friends wherever they go. So I hope they come to Japan and make new friends, local friends, and it will be a great promotion of the country too.
Remember the good advice that your mother gave you, wear sensible shoes. people are reserved, rambunctiousness and boisterousness on the train and all that kind of thing is not smiled upon, and they are looking forward to welcoming the Irish warmly. They know our reputation, and everything we've seen and hear, they like us, and that's a good thing.
And that's our reporter Paul O'Flynn in Japan. Remember, Ireland's first game against Scotland on Sunday. Full coverage here on RTE.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.